Next.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a morning news and public affairs director, as well as an evening news and public affairs director to manage the news and public affairs programming. For these two full-time positions, we're looking for people with proven experience in audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
It's 9 o'clock Pacific time, and you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the veil of the monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. And the frogs that you're going to hear out of my throat anyway this morning. Let's see, I've got a button marked cough. I'm going to test it. There, I hope that worked. Except for a schmeck. Yes, good morning. A lot of things happening. The Democratic debate started last night, and President Trump has been addressed by yet another rape accusation. Our pussy grabber in chief has to answer once again. Latest rape accusation against President Trump is credible, of course, for a number of reasons, but principally because there are so many such stories now, and the modus operandi is approximately the same within them. So imagine, if you will, that there was once a president who was actually impeached because of consensual sex. And now, we accept this fascist, rapist, chimpanzee's behavior as far as too far below the bar for action. How the frog has boiled. So here's the observation of a transgender gal, me. I tried various levels of passing as a woman. When I was working years ago as a municipal bus driver in the Portland area, I worked for TriMet and transitioned in 2001, and so I kind of went back and forth on how hard I was going to work at that. At one point, I got pretty competent at it, getting my posture and my makeup just so, practicing eliminating male gestures, introducing feminine habits, wearing large breast pads, because I'm a large woman. I'm 6 foot, 240. Anyway, I had lipstick. I was altering my voice, etc. I knew I had it right. When men on the bus started telling me how to drive the bus, now they think I'm a woman. So, one day a man started rather aggressively trying to get me to agree to a date. As I was driving, he offered an angle to each of my rejections. Now, this is a very public thing. It's like, I'm trying to drive this bus safely. I'm trying to get it right and trying to get everybody where they need to go and pick up everybody needs to be picked up. And this guy won't shut up. He's just trying to get a date and won't take no for an answer. So he had an angle to each of my rejections. Sound familiar? Until I finally told him outright that I wasn't interested and that he should sit down. As gently as I could. Now, at that point, and all the women listening to me right now know exactly what I'm going to say, he became insulting. Because in his opinion, my proper attitude towards his obnoxious effort should be nothing but gratitude. After all, an actual man had expressed an interest in not young and not trim me. I had broken this code by finally being direct, and I thought how much easier it was for me to deal with him as an employed, confident person in my 40s, as someone who'd grown up as a man, and I thought how confusing and difficult it must be for women, for girls of 12 years of age, if they're lucky, to deal with that sort of pressure, with its implication that a female does not have the right to choose her time and place for courting and flirting, much less to effectively resist it and to demand respect. Unheard of. But I had, even as a tranny, I had enough privilege as a white adult to shake it off. But that sort of grinding rape culture encounter is one thing I never had to deal with as a perceived male. It's part of the whole enculturation of femininity that we accept as normal and natural when in fact it is oppressive. And so this brings me back to Trump. We're inculcated to accept a degraded, predatory model of sex relations as normal. It isn't good for anyone. It isn't good for men. Some men consciously resist it. Most men don't. It's a framework for rage, frustration, alienation, falseness, and rape. I remember learning the aggressor model as a teenage closeted trans and finding it as false as it was awkward. It's not a thing I felt atavistically. I mean, I was a willowy thing anyway when I was a teenager. It just didn't work. But I would go through the motions the larger I got, and the more I identified as an adult male, the more I tried it. And for the privileged and or sociopathic boys, I'm thinking frat boys, it was an easy mode to slide into and identify with. But I don't remember anyone besides them actually enjoying it. So, for example, when I read of the famous 1962 Tanzanian laughing schoolgirl mystery phenomenon, presented as a scientific mystery, it presents rather differently to me. The schoolgirls, adolescent schoolgirls, lived in a village oppressive to women. They began to laugh together and couldn't stop. The episode ended after days with more than a dozen girls crying, collapsing, vomiting. There was no toxic chemical or biological source. They were not intoxicated, but they were at the end of their childhoods, and that meant the beginning of their lives as less than human, as isolated livestock and slaves to men. Facing the death of all agency and the end of all joy, facing genital mutilation and intended to destroy their ability to enjoy sex, they giggled maniacally together, perhaps the only display of agency left to them. It's not a mystery to me. It's a horror, and it's not so different here in the United States. Transitioning from an apparent male to a female in this culture without the compelling reason of transgenderism would be a stupid decision. It's never an arbitrary decision. Living as a woman puts me in a position to experience dismissal, poverty, violence, or rape like all other women. So when I went in to be diagnosed with transgenderism, the first thing the assigned psychological professional said to me was, "Are you depressed?" His task was to see if I had entered a psychotic, self-hating delusion. In fact, there are a very small number of apparent transgender women who do that to themselves. I remember a guy who did that to himself, and I use the word guy advisedly. He detransitioned when he came out of the psychosis. But there's probably not enough people to justify that automatic screening procedure. Trump's rape reputation goes hand in hand with his demagogic racism. It's all about hierarchy. It's all about creating a society divided against itself. It's comforting to the masses of rapists and bigots and cowed victims who voted for him. I insist that we see it for what it is. The Trump counter-revolution is a grave danger to humanity. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Now, later in this show, at the bottom of the hour, I do hope to have Arun Gupta in the studio. I'm looking forward to that. An excellent writer. He's written for The Guardian and is familiar to the Occupy and movements and to the left for his excellent writings. And he is a founding editor of Independent Magazine and was a founding editor of Occupy Wall Street Journal. He's working on a book. And so hope to see him at the bottom of the hour. Right now, I'd like to get into some headlines and to ask you for your calls and comments. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. There's a lot to talk about, and it's hard to keep one topic up because there's so many horrific things happening. The collapse of the world ecology from the climate disaster, the roaring racism and trans and homophobia being encouraged by the Trump administration, the racism, and of course the trophy of racism, the immigrant, anti-immigrant policy. In that context, there were Democratic debates. I printed out a description of the concentration camps, and it may take me a moment to find it. So rather than just go to that, I'll say I would like to take your calls. And yes, here I have a description of the concentration camps. The camps were poorly administered from the outset and became increasingly overcrowded when the troops implemented the internment strategy on a vast scale. Conditions were terrible for the health of the internees, mainly due to neglect, poor hygiene, and bad sanitation. The supply of all items was unreliable. The food rations were meager. The inadequate shelter, poor diet, bad hygiene, and overcrowding led to malnutrition and endemic contagious diseases such as influenza, to which the children were particularly vulnerable. Coupled with a shortage of modern medical facilities, many of the internees died. That's a quote from Wikipedia, but it's not a quote about the American concentration camps, or the most recent American concentration camps. I'm not talking about the Trail of Tears, and I'm not talking about the Japanese internment. In this case, I was quoting the British internment of the Boers, which so many died from the way that they were treated in those concentration camps. They were camps, they concentrated people together, they treated them like crap, and people died. And now we see this in the United States. And so there was, as Rochelle's noticing, or was noting, there are people who object to the phrase concentration camp being applied to our concentration camps, but I read that description from the Boer War, and those concentration camps were notorious. That's how it starts. That's how it is right now. That's what we're doing. That's how evil we are. That's who we're at. I mean, that's where we're at, and that's who we are. And that's America, 2019. So what to do, and your calls and comments are welcome. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. There are Democratic debates were split up because there were so many candidates, and NBC News summarized some of the comments from what each candidate said, so I'll go down a few of those. These are quotes from the candidates from last night's debate. From Bill de Blasio, "There's something that sets me apart," he said, "from all of my colleagues running in this race, and that is for the last 21 years I've been raising a black son in America, and I had to have very, very serious talks with my son Dante about how to protect himself on the streets of our city and all over this country," end quote. From Tim Ryan, quote, "If you want to beat Mitch McConnell, this better be a working class party. If you want to go to Kentucky and take his rear end out, and if you want to take Lindsey Graham out, you have to have a blue-collar party," end quote. Julian Castro said, quote, "We need a Marshall Plan for Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador so that people can find safety and opportunity at home instead of coming to the United States to seek it," end quote. Cory Booker, quote, "I live in a low-income black and brown community. I see every day that this economy is not working for average Americans. The indicators that are being used from GDP to Wall Street's rankings is not helping people in my community," end quote. Elizabeth Warren, by the way, Elizabeth Warren got way more airtime than anybody else. It would seem that the debate team had decided to emphasize her presence. Quoting Elizabeth Warren, "What's been missing is courage. Courage in Washington to take on the giants. That's part of the corruption in this system. It has been far too long that the monopolies have been making the campaign contributions, have been funding the super PACs, have been out there making sure that the influence is heard and felt in every single decision that gets made in Washington," end quote. From Beto O'Rourke. Oh, by the way, Beto, surprised by speaking, or actually responding in Spanish to a question. They were in Miami, and one of the questions was asked in Spanish. But in English, he said, "So we must begin impeachment now so that we have the facts and truth and follow them as far as they go and as high up as they reach and save this democracy. And if we've not been able to do that in the year or the year that follows, and under my administration, our Department of Justice will pursue these facts and ensure that there are consequences, there is accountability, and there is justice. It's the only way that we save this country," end quote. Amy Klobuchar is quoted saying, "I don't think we should conduct foreign policy in our bathrobe at 5 in the morning," end quote. Tulsi Gabbard said, quote, Maybe many people in this country can relate to the fact that I grew up in a socially conservative home, held views when I was very young that I no longer hold today," end quote. Jay Inslee, Quote, the biggest threat to the security of the United States is Donald Trump, end quote. John Delaney, quote, we're on a mission to find the America that's been lost. Lost through infighting, lost through inaction. We're so much better than this. We're a country that's used to do things, end quote. And of course, now those quotes are from NBC, which I frequently criticize because it is or has been owned by General Electric as the neutron bomb company. But I'll go to the next caller, 503-231-8187. And hello, you're on the air. Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, hello. I've listened to you for a long time. I've ridden your bus, and I read your posts that you put on Facebook, and I hope you're writing a book. But anyway, I think that what a lot of people are, why there's so much inaction is we're seeing this as a worldwide problem, the rise of fascism and the downtrodden of the poor and the poor education and the degradation of our physical environment, and people feel helpless and hopeless and overwhelmed. There was a recent study released where suicides have skyrocketed amongst young people. And I grew up in Portland, and I remember what Portland was like in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And there was always racism, and there was always exclusive neighborhoods. I grew up in an exclusively white neighborhood, and one year we had a black family move in, and they stayed maybe one semester. I tried to be friends with the little girl. I think we were in third grade, and all my friends shunned me because I dared to touch her. And a lot of people in the West Coast, the white people, you know, even the ones who say, I'm not racist, they really subtly are, and they don't include their neighbors that are not like them. They don't have the same education. They don't come from the same country. They don't speak the same language. And so we exclude people. And unfortunately, it's kind of a worldwide thing. And now people are leaving South America and Central America and making their way up here trying to get a better life. Who knows what they're told down there? They're thinking, America, we're going to go to the United States. And then they get here and they're treated so awfully.
Well, when you're subject to that sort of gang extortion, I don't know if you think
awful.
About what the next place is like or not. You may jump from the frying pan into the fire just because you've got to jump.
Exactly. Because you're so desperate. And you're trying to save your family and save yourself. And the thing is that a lot of people who vote, they don't vote every election. They don't realize the local votes are very important, too. They feel like the big votes, the national votes, oh, it's all corrupt. Our vote won't matter, even though that's what they want you to think. So you don't vote. So therefore, they take over. And the big corporations having so much say in what happens instead of the people is really... I can't even express how horrified I am at what has become of the country. What really was all along, but I was educated to believe that the people mattered. I was educated in a fancy private school, and I was told that my vote mattered, and I was told that what I thought mattered, and my legislators and senators and presidents would listen to me. But I find that's not true. And it's horrifying, and I think a lot of people are overwhelmed. Anyway, I'm going to get off the line and listen to your wonderful show. Write a book. You're fantastic. Bye.
Well, thanks for your comments, and thanks for the boost. I'm hoping to have Arun Gupta at the bottom of the hour. Excellent writer. I think you will enjoy and be educated by his insights. Right now it's 9:17 Pacific time. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Have been talking about the Democratic debates, have been talking about the concentration camps, the ICE concentration camps. I'm being a little sloppy in calling them that. The Border Patrol is involved, and of course the Trump administration is driving the whole thing. And as we now hear and see on the media, people starting with, I would like to say, Oregon's Jeff Merkley, when it comes to big name politicians. It started with Jeff Merkley going down to Texas and being refused entry to a holding pen. And we now know from people who have actually been in there and who have some journalistic capacity that the conditions are horrific, that America and the Trump administration, and also I want to say all of the sorry bigots who support Trump, are crushing little children and should be deeply ashamed of it, but probably have an excuse. The whole idea being from Trump administration, the whole idea is to fire up the frightened white bass. And the other idea being to discourage people in Central America from coming up at all, and so avoid the social changes that are occurring, for example, in Europe as people come up from the southern cones to seek a better life, to seek life at all. I say to seek a better life. Certainly there's some economic advantage, but when you're about to die, then you just jump. You have to get a move on. So many people have drowned in the Mediterranean just wanting to live and risking it, knowing that there's a good chance that they'll die on those leaky rafts. And then they wash up and the photographs come out. Bill is next. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, okay. Well, one thing I want to talk about is I'm Jewish, and it's hard for me to hear this term concentration camps, because I know that what my people went through is a little bit different. Not that I'm saying this is good, but a little bit different than what is going on south of the border.
No one said they were extermination camps. It's only the right wing that's made that connection.
So, and you realize that these camps have been going since 2015 and 2014, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Obama administration.
It's not about the presidency.
Oh yes, it is.
About the government.
No, there's no way to hold that pretense. He's made things much worse.
So you're saying it was better before when the exact same thing was happening?
It wasn't the exact same thing. The deliberate overcrowding of the camps was not happening. The shoving of people under overpasses with pins around them was not happening.
That was definitely happening. And why weren't you saying stuff about it then, when Obama was president?
I was against aggressive immigration policies, and I've made that pretty clear. And you don't know apparently what I do on the show.
No, I've been listening for years, and you weren't using the term concentration camps back then. As a Jewish citizen, I find it kind of offensive.
Well, as a Jewish citizen, you should get it straight that I'm not talking about extermination camps.
Well, the word concentration camps implies extermination camps.
No, it doesn't. And my heritage is also partly Jewish. So, you know, you can't pull that card on me. Sorry.
There's no card to pull. I'm just pointing out facts. And you realize...
Now, the fact is an aggressive racist policy is being implemented under our noses, and we are being encouraged to accept a new and sadistic turn towards our fellow citizens of this planet.
And you realize that these people are running to concentration camps, not running from concentration camps, as in the German story.
These are just excuses. These are dodges. Don't kid yourself.
I'm anti this situation, and I'm anti-negative government, and I'm definitely not happy with our government as it stands right now, but I'm not going to delude myself and be like, this is concentration camps like Germany and Trump's Hitler.
That's a, okay, reason. Well then please agree with me that that's a straw man. The left is not saying that this is Hitler's concentration camps. The right is trying to make that case. That's what's called getting a straw man and beating it up.
Right. I want you to answer me this question. Why are these people running to America right now? Why are they coming here in droves?
Because America has destabilized their countries. Starting in 1954, that accelerated under Guatemala, although it certainly started in the 19th century with the invasion of the American kings in that area, where we treated people like livestock, took away their way of making a living, and created vast plantations where they were only useful as occasional labor. Next, we instituted death squad governments. And that's why those countries are so unstable, and that's why they are ruled by gangs now.
So I think that the real problem is that these countries are ruled by cartels, and we need to go in and fix the problem in the sense that we need to create stable governments within the places where these people live.
We could start that by arresting some very respected, rich, white citizens in the United States who own those cartels.
But what? Like, why do you have to put the white label? Why can't they just be rich people? Why do you have
because
to? Because
they are white, and whiteness has everything to do with the whiteness, and the idea of superiority and normalcy of whiteness has everything to do with the comfort in creating a subclass of brown people.
It just seems like instead of focusing on the fact that we have a humanitarian crisis instead of pitting people against each other and giving people labels based on race, which I was always told by Martin Luther King that you're not supposed to put labels of people based on race, and then maybe focus on the humanitarian aspect to fix the problem. By labeling people with these races, saying white people this, white people that, that's not fixing the problem.
That's just identifying the problem. You know, to get over whiteness, the first thing that we're going to have to do is acknowledge whiteness as a crime. And then to get past whiteness, we're going to have to say, okay, we've done this whiteness. This whiteness exists.
Are you white?
Yes.
Are you white?
That's right.
Dude, then are you the problem?
Yes.
Oh, my God, then maybe you should quit your job because you're the problem. You shouldn't be on air. You're the problem. You just said it.
Gosh, that's awfully simplistic. Would you like to hear what I have to say about that?
No, because you're obviously...
You don't want to hear? Well, I'm going to hang up on you then, and everyone else can hear. And I will explain calmly when it comes to whiteness. Now, it turns out that my skin is pale. If I had scale, it would be pale too. And I am descended, from a bunch of people, principally Irish. There's some Germans in there. And so I was brought up in a certain way. I speak English. I'm well educated. And this makes me perceived to be white. This gives me a lot of privileges. I think I'm just going to go into this for a minute because this keeps coming up. And I hope you're still listening, mister, because we need to get this straight. To end the crime of whiteness, we need to acknowledge it. We need to repent of it, having acknowledged it. And we need to atone for it. So I'll go through those three steps. First, we acknowledge whiteness. Now, I am white to the extent that I get privilege from and identify myself as and act as a white. I'm not concerned about this in terms of existence, because my existence actually falls under that rubric, but it is false. Whiteness is false. It's a story we tell ourselves. It's a story we tell ourselves that white skin, the pale skin, goes along with a normal or superior method of acting. This is an excuse to cover the genocide that has set up the hierarchies of wealth in this country. But the fact is, we can separate ourselves from whiteness, not immediately. I'm not going to stop getting the privileges of whiteness, but you can get to where I am, comfort with my whiteness. Oh my goodness. I'm white, I act as white, I live as white, I'm not really white. That's a little contradictory, but it's the fact. And that last part, not really white, is because no one really is. This is just a status. And one of the stories that I tell to show how arbitrary it is that under the apartheid South Africa regime in the 80s, Japanese people were white. And if you go to John Day, Oregon, and ask them if Japanese people are white, or right here in Portland, you'll get the answer, well, of course not. Because it's not really about the paleness of the skin. The Japanese government negotiated with the apartheid government to get the privileges of white people. It's about privilege. It's about status. So to acknowledge the crimes of whiteness, you must first acknowledge that it is an arbitrary status that has been created through warfare and torture. I'm thinking of slavery. You can't have slavery without torture. There's no such thing. You torture people. If you want slaves, you torture people en masse. You make sure that they understand that they are always constantly facing torture. So don't do that to people of pale skin. Then you create this class of people of pale skin. Doesn't matter whether their folks came from Poland or where, or from Ireland, different gene groups. Doesn't matter. It's not actually a race. It's a status. So the criminality of whiteness, its falseness, acknowledge. That's inadequate, but it's a start. So we'll go past to the next start, to the next point. Repent. Repent of whiteness. Acknowledge all of these things and decide that you're against it. You're going to stop doing it. You're going to find all of the little cracks of microaggression in your own psyche, and you're going to stop perpetrating them. Usually these are verbal, but not always. And someone else was mentioning not including other people as fully accepted human beings. This is part of my whiteness that I still do. I just walk right past people of color and don't even look at them. Of course, I don't look at people generally because I'm very alienated, but that goes double for people of color. I don't even see their faces. So, and they see that and feel that, and that's microaggression. And so to repent of it having acknowledged what whiteness is and that I don't want to do it, getting to that step, then I'm ready to apologize to someone and to make sure they are comforted and know that whatever microaggression I just pulled is going to be reversed, confronted. And they may not feel like going that far. They may just feel like expressing their rage, and I'm going to accept that because I've acknowledged the whiteness. So I've got to acknowledgement, repentance, and now let's get to atonement. To tear down whiteness, to destroy whiteness, which is necessary for the survival of the world because it is so linked to status and to corporate power and to imperial power. We must acknowledge, repent, and atone. So that means economic atonement. That means reparations to all people of color. And that means now, and that means substantially. The power of the corporations due to the acceleration of productivity through the machine age, the power of the elites, the maldistribution of wealth is titanic. So to take that down, that means you're against capitalism. And some of you are saying, oh, you know, you're losing me because you don't know what capitalism is and you think that it's just economic activity. I'm not against economic activity. I'm against paying one person 10,000 times what another person is paid. That's ridiculous. We can be much more rational about that. We can even be a little bit capitalistic. I don't really care. I'm not that idealistic about it. But we live in a situation in which people have billions of dollars while other people starve. That's criminal, should be illegal. Now, atoning for whiteness means paying the money that has been extracted from very profitably from people of color. Now, let's go back to the first step again, acknowledging whiteness also means acknowledging all the privileges that I enjoy from whiteness. For example, my grandfather was included in the New Deal. He was white enough. And he got, I'm thinking of my father's father. He got included in the New Deal, and this was pretty good for him as a sharecropper and meant that my father did not die because he was born in December of 33 in rural Texas and could easily have, and my grandfather never forgave him for being another mouth to feed. That's how desperate they were. They were hungry. Comes along New Deal. People of color not included, especially in that area, not far from there. The Tulsa riots had made sure there wasn't a black population around to enjoy that relief. Now, skip ahead to the GI Bill, excluded from people of color. Given to my father, though, and the GI Bill meant that not only did he get to go to college and have it paid for, but he got a stipend for living. A stipend for living. You go to college, we'll pay for your tuition and books, and we're going to pay for the time that you're not spending working, we're going to make sure you get to go to college and get all the way through it and not have to worry about it. That's how good the GI Bill was. And the answer for people of color was no. So that's two steps up right there. That's whiteness. Acknowledge whiteness. Whiteness is a crime of status perpetrated against people who are not included. Going back, repent. Once acknowledging it, repent that it is evil to take and to maintain a status that is unjust. To atone. Pay up, man. That's what atoning means. Pay up. So, yeah, I'm white. This is one of these conservatives do not like complex things. This isn't very complex. It's just a little bit of understanding. Whiteness is a status. I have that status. I am white. Whiteness is false. I am a human being with pale skin. I am infected by whiteness. I wish to be free of it. That means that I am a human being. And no human being is actually white since it's a false status. So that's whiteness, and that's what I intend to do about it, and I'm not one step back. And it's liberating. It's exciting to me to have these realizations and to move forward on this. And so I think the Jew who called me talking about whiteness, because Jews get kind of a degraded whiteness. Jews get to be white some of the time and get to be, well, you know what happened, shoved into concentration camps. Other times, Jews are under attack from the Nazis in the United States. Why anyone would be so degraded as to take the status Nazi ever anywhere is beyond my b- belief, but it is happening here in the United States. And it looks like Arun Gupta is going to join me. I'm so glad that you could be here. And I'll wait for a moment while he grabs a microphone and headset. And Arun, I was just talking about whiteness.
talking about whiteness.
Talking about the three things to do about it, to acknowledge it, to repent of it, to atone for it by way of destroying it. So, and this is rejected by a caller that I just had. So I'm having a good time. And also topics, well, let me talk about Arun Gupta. Founding editor, I just got this out of the Guardian blurb, so you get to correct this. Founding editor of the Independent Magazine, and was a founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He is working on a book. Is that correct still?
I am working on a book called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, Bacon. A Junk Food Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste.
I love it. Thanks for coming in. Well, and you wrote, you have been writing in this last month some very incisive works about the concentration camps, and so I would like to ask you to comment on that.
Well, they're concentration camps. We need to be using that term. Clearly, that's what's going on. You know, this whole kind of hullabaloo began a couple of weeks ago when Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez called them concentration camps, and she was citing scholars, including an author of his recent book of a global history of concentration camps. And this caused the usual outrage, and ironically, one of the people who went hardest after her was Liz Cheney, who is the daughter of Darth Cheney, the former vice president in the Bush administration, who is responsible for setting up this global torture network, who was really the instigator in many ways of the Iraq War. You know, if we remember back to the Bush years, Cheney was, in many ways, had more power than Bush. You know, people called it a co-presidency, but in many ways, he was really running the show there. And the Iraq War, within its first 3 years, was estimated to have killed about 650,000 civilians, which is an absolutely staggering death toll in a country of 27 million. And so this is where the criticism is coming from of mass murderers who are complaining that you're calling it concentration camps. But I think one of the best articles critiquing this was in the New Yorker recently by Masha Gessen. She's a Russian journalist, now an American journalist, who was persecuted by Putin. And she pointed out that the whole reason that there's this opposition to calling concentration camps is because concentration camps are supposed to be something that are unimaginable. Now, you know, there's this. Now, I think there is, you know, because I've been talking to a lot of people about this, and including rabbis, you know, there is this kind of like legitimate trauma in the Jewish community, obviously, over the Holocaust. But never again, you know, means never again. It doesn't mean if we want to treat the Holocaust as something completely unique, something that is singular in human history, that is the wrong approach. Because if you say never again, then obviously they can be a never again if Auschwitz and Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and Ravensbrück, all these death camps, were completely unique, then it means you cannot have anything like the Holocaust ever again. But the whole point is that the Holocaust was not the Holocaust in 1933 when the concentration camps started to appear. And we know from history that the term concentration camps, you know, there's like it. People generally associate it with the British war in South Africa, but there are two instances where the modern concentration camp appear before that. That is Spain's rule of Cuba, where they had these camps that were called reconcentration camps, and then Germany in Namibia. And more and broadly, we can also say that the reservations system, especially in the 19th century, century. And the idea of a concentration camp is you're concentrating people of the same group in one area for no reason other than they are of that group. So by definition, these are concentration camps that we have on the border. You know, it's illegal what's going on in many ways. Yesterday, U.S. asylum officers who work in the citizenship agency as part of a Department of Homeland Security, their union sued the Trump administration over their asylum policy, saying it's illegal, saying it's violating U.S. law, saying it's violating international law. I read the complaint. It's really interesting. Folks should take a look at it because they're citing all these instances throughout history where the U.S. had no problem absorbing large amounts of migrants in a very short period. And the asylum officers are arguing that the new policy that went in place earlier this year, where they're forcing migrants to stay in Mexico, you know, like in Tijuana, they have this metering system, right, where you get a number, like you're in a deli and you're supposed to wait in line. And there are over 8,000 people who now have a number. And some days they just don't call anyone. This is completely illegal under U.S. law. And under U.S. law as a signatory to various international conventions. So, you know, I think part of the thing we have to do here is flip the script in terms of who the real criminals are here. You know, we know that. I mean, Trump is a complete criminal in every single way imaginable. I mean, you know, when he was doing his casinos and buildings, he's completely mobbed up.
That's mob is the word. Yeah, that's what I think of when I look at the Trump administration.
Yeah. I mean, he talks like a wise guy. You know, people have written about this before. His language is exactly that of a mobster. His Michael Cohen, you know, is just like he uses the same techniques as a mobster, where, you know, he doesn't say anything outright. It's all winks and nudges and code words. So, you know, this is a completely criminal administration in every single way. And this is what the asylum officers are suing Trump over, because they're saying, one, that they're subjecting these migrants to persecution and danger by forcing them to remain in Mexico. Two, that they can handle the amount of migrants, that this is not an issue. They're saying, we have the apparatus, we can do this. And three, and that they're forcing the asylum officers to also break the law with their policy of the remain in Mexico. So this is an illegal persecution under U.S. law, and certainly, you know, I think this stuff rises to crimes against humanity. And we have to remember, concentration camp does not equal death camp, right? This is what the whole controversy is over.
No, that's the straw man that the right's bringing up, saying, oh, you know, but they're the ones that have tripped the Godwin's law switch and brought this up. As you say, they're not extermination camps. No one said that they were, but they are concentration camps of the ugliest sort, now that we have the details.
And remember, it's you know, is this like, is the right wing in solidarity with the Jewish community? I mean, you know, Trump is pushing out the vilest anti-Semitic means. He's embracing neo-Nazis in Charlottesville. His supporters are going and shooting up synagogues, and yet they want to somehow cloak themselves in the mantle of defending the Jewish community. I mean, the problem is this is, it all happens so rapidly. It's so just breathtakingly audacious that I think you have a media that is completely unprepared to know how to deal with this issue. And, you know, and we also had that amazing exchange on Twitter that I'm sure a lot of, because it jumped into the news, where Chris Hayes, who I think is a good guy, I've spoken with him on panels before. He's one of the better journalists. He's like the leftmost of the liberals out there, but he was being, you know, like a typical squishy liberal and saying, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't call them concentration camps because it upsets people. It's just like, That's not the issue. The issue is we are killing people. We are creating these like hothouses of danger and disease. This is what concentration camps are.
Yes, and that's a logical view, which brings me to 63 million people voting for Trump. Now, I want to talk about this. Okay, so you've brought out a logical
I just want to finish
argument.
That. Yes, so go ahead. Chris Hayes says this and, you know, says that, you know, we shouldn't go down this path. Otherwise, we're going to invoke Godwin's law. And Mike Godwin came up with this one of these rules of the internet that every argument, if it goes on long enough, will bring up Hitler analogies. And then Mike Godwin responds to Chris Hayes saying, like, actually, Chris, they are concentration camps.
Right on. I did not know that. That's interesting. Well, what I wanted to get to is America as a cult. There are definitely cult-like aspects to the whole concept of America. And this is particularly true of the 63 million people who voted for and who, however many now support Trump. And in a cult, you have certain tenets and you hold to them. And the basis for accepting the tenet is not logic. It's simply its repetition and insistence. And ironically, the more bizarre or unprovable or anti-factual these tenets are, the more you hold to the cult because you can't afford then to be on the outside of the people who agree that, you know, the UFO people are coming. So in America, you have there are things that you cannot disagree with, that we are not an imperialum. We are not an imperium. We do not have concentration camps. We are good people. We are exceptional. All of these things have to be accepted. And so when facts are brought up showing otherwise, they are simply dismissed. It's fake news. So what do we do about that?
Well, so I think you bring up a good point, but I think it's also important that we not paint with too broad of a brush. There is certainly a cult of personality, a dictatorship cult around Trump that he encourages just as complete slavish obedience. This is why, you know, he is so much into creating this basically looking glass as funhouse, a mirror vision of the world, because what it is saying his reality is the only reality that you should pay attention to. And so it's a way of binding many of his supporters to him. You know, but let's also remember that the reason a lot of people voted for him was because they despise Hillary Clinton, who was a terrible candidate. The Clintons did a lot of terrible things over their entire political career, and you know I was out on the campaign trail. There was no love of Hillary Clinton even among people who voted for her.
No, and I saw something that stuck with me when I was in Philadelphia. I've repeated this one too many times, I fear, but there was a class division. I went to the streets of Philadelphia intentionally to get the street view of the convention in 2016, and I could find all the Bernie supporters on the streets, just everywhere, having these wonderful discussions under the courthouse. You know, how stereotypical is this of Philadelphia, talking about democracy and rule of law and all this sort of thing. And where were the Clintonites? I couldn't find them until I went into the expensive air-conditioned hotels. That's where they were. Mm-hmm. And they seemed a little frightened. Mm-hmm. And there were security people there. And there was just this monstrous class division going on. And there's more to say about that, but yeah.
Well, what was interesting, you know, I was on the inside of both conventions. And so in Cleveland at the RNC, what was really interesting to me is it didn't reek of wealth in the way that the Democratic National Convention attendees did. They were much more like buffed with their, you know, sanded skin and, their tailored clothing. there was this kind of weird class division because, you know, a lot of Republicans were not coming on board for the Trump campaign because they figured he was going to lose.
I thought they were doomed. I remember him getting onto the stage and groping his daughter, and I thought, oh, that's it. No one will vote for this scumbag. Oh, my God.
Well, you know, I mean, it's as I've been saying, Hillary Clinton should only be the answer to the trivia question, is it possible to run a worse presidential campaign than Al Gore? You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, we're not going to relitigate that. But
no.
So, secondly, a lot of people voted for Trump for the tax cuts, you know, because they knew they were going to. So, you know, we shouldn't forget that. So there's one, Hillary haters, two, tax cuts, three, Democratic Party abandonment. So shortly after the election, I went to Indiana to talk to the workers at Carrier, at three different factories where Trump said he was going to save jobs. And remember, he did quote unquote save some jobs. Of course, he lied about the number. A lot of the workers were being laid off and he never, bothered to mention that. And these were all, unionized, factories. Union members, and a majority of them who I interviewed voted for Trump. And the thing I kept, and I did like these hour-long interviews with every single worker, 17 different workers, and the thing I just kept hearing over and over again was NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA. And who is responsible for NAFTA? Clinton. And the workers would rattle off, well, you know, they're, when I would ask them about their work history, and they're, well, there used to be this Navstar plant or this Delphi plant or this Alcoa plant. It was like they were naming all these like old baseball stars, and they were aware of like all these factories that had closed over the year, and they attributed all to NAFTA. And much of that is not incorrect. At least, you know, it's like 2 or maybe 3 million net loss of industrial jobs attributed.
And they picked up on Clinton's response, which was, oh, look over there.
Well, yeah. And you know, by the time the campaign ended, she was, you know, I was making the joke. She was for the Clinton administration before she was against it. She was basically running against every single signature policy of the Clinton years. She was running against NAFTA. She turned on TPP. And so she was playing right into Trump's hands of crooked Hillary, because you couldn't trust anything she said. She was running against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she had previously been for. She was running against welfare reform, which is really one of the most hideous crimes domestically of the modern political era. You know, 2 million women and children within a few years were thrown off the welfare rolls into poverty. She was running against mass incarceration, which the Clintons supercharged during the 90s, you know, where you saw these dramatic rises in broadly in mass incarcerations, as well these huge surges in the incarceration rate of women, and the incarceration rate of black women increased something like 800%. Don't quote me on that, but it was this massive increase in the 1990s under Clinton. She was running,
because they're busted for not turning in their partners. Yeah, go ahead.
She was running against the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So, I mean, she was running against everything that the Clinton administration had basically done. So, of course, who could trust her?
That's exactly it. As a union member myself, it's like, pick up on that sort of, that's just corporate style gaslighting. It's like, oh, I have no ideological reason for changing my position, but I'll say to you, no, I changed my position, and they know they're not going to be held to it. That's true of Biden right now with his flip-flop on abortion. I mean, if he had come out and said, well, I've been thinking about it, and, you know, despite my upbringing, and, you know, I was wrong before, and women have a right to control their own bodies, or whatever ideological reason he would give. No, he just came out and said that he wasn't going to be anti-abortion anymore, which is not credible.
Well, I mean, these anti-abortion Democrats, they are so effing stupid. I'm against abortion. Okay, great. Don't have one. Don't force your religion on other people.
Speaking of cults.
You know. So, we'll get to see Uncle Joe in action tonight, which should be entertaining.
Yes.
I guarantee you everyone is going to go after him.
How are they going to shut up Sanders tonight?
You know, they're going to have some stupid question about, like, America isn't a socialist country, you know.
Do you think they'd do that or just avoid the S word altogether? Start talking loudly about baseball.
It's hard to avoid it anymore. I think, you know, from last night's debate, I'll be honest, I did watch it, but I was zoning out at times because it's just like no one's going to remember this in 2 weeks, or even if they remember it in 1 week. But the questions about climate change just seem terrible for the most part. And the end when they were asking, you know, what's the biggest threat facing America, I smacked my forehead because it's just like, China? Really? China is it the biggest threat facing America? I mean, I have no love of a system that melds the worst of authoritarian bureaucratic communism and capitalism, but at the same time I'm like, how could China do worse than what we've done in the world?
Well, yeah, and so these new debates are coming up, and I actually didn't watch the last ones. I have read the news coverage of it, but I hope to catch this tonight, and I hope that it does have some lasting impact, but it's not a very strong hope. It's 9:54 Pacific time. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell in the room with Arun Gupta, writer and author, and we've been talking about the concentration camps and the Democratic candidates.
One thing I do want to say about the concentration camps, yeah. I'm working with some really amazing organizers and campaigners, and we're going to be putting out a national call soon for a mass mobilization against concentration camps. You know, we want to see if we can spark something similar to Standing Rock, to Black Lives Matter, to Occupy Wall Street. You know, as I live in New York, I visit Portland frequently, but I was there.
I was going to ask you about that.
yeah. Portland's got nice weather. It's in you know, nice change of pace from New York. Air travel is my one little sin, but you know, I also figure like, hey, I'm not gonna have kids.
Why don't you take the maglev trains?
That would be nice. The Hyperloop. You know, Elon Musk is building them right now as we speak. We're working to put this call out, and I was in New York when Occupy Wall Street happened, and if folks remember that, it was in the air, but you know what one of the sparks was the Adbusters call, and that's all it was a call to Occupy Wall Street on September 17th, 2011, and I was there that first day, and there were just a couple of dozen people there, but within a week it exploded, and then it just within 2 weeks it was spreading like wildfire around the country, and in 2016, I drove across doing reporting around the country, and before the conventions, and at one point I had a chance to go to Standing Rock, but I was just like, it was really out of the way, and I had to get to Cleveland for the RNC. But the other thing too was it was tiny at that point in the summer of 2016. We were hearing there's maybe only 50 or 100 people there, so I was like, okay, let's just skip it. So it didn't explode for a couple of months. And so what we're trying to see is if we can get some momentum going, can we get a mass mobilization, particularly down to the border, to shut down these concentration camps?
I think there is an additional effect to these efforts that you've mentioned to occupy. I could see not just the energy, but actually the veterans of the 99 confrontation in Seattle at the Occupy, as it happened here. I only saw it here in Portland. It was massive here. And that energy, there's a little bit of that at Standing Rock. And there's more than that. It's in the Bernie campaign right now. And I know I'm being very vague, but I'm just talking about, for example, Occupy Wall Street and the 99 battle in Seattle, cracking the door in people's consciousnesses to the fact that we have this class system, whether it's acknowledged or not, that we have this grotesque maldistribution of wealth and power, and something, maybe we don't know what yet, needs to be done about it. You know, for Marxists, anarcho-Marxists like myself, is I have this prescription. I have this place I want to try to go.
Well, I've got a simple solution, guillotines.
Yeah. Guillotines, I've noticed, have become popular in iconography lately. Oh, my goodness, with the guillotine, we've chopped off our time.
We'll line Wall Street with them.
Well, that would be an interesting reminder.
It's the new wealth tax. Take a little off the top.
A little off the top. I like that. Well, Arun Gupta, thank you so much for joining me. This is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, the Heather McCoy Show. Please join KBOO at kboo.fm. You've been listening on 90.7 FM and other frequencies. Frequencies coming out of our great big red and white Eiffel Tower on the West Hills and via kboo.fm. We go out to you and all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next is the Heather McCoy Show.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stop the Hate, Saturday, June 29th at noon at Chapman Square in Portland. On Saturday, June 29th, the Proud Boys Hate Group is planning to gather in downtown Portland, looking for targets for violent attacks. This can mean assaulting random pedestrians, looking for progressive activists to attack, or targeting community events. Those against white supremacy and fascists will gather to defend our community against this racist political violence. Again, that's Stop the Hate, Saturday, June 29th at noon at Chapman Square, 210 Southwest Main in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.